So I was looking at the tea in the back and contemplating the nature of change. I remembered when tea in this country pretty much meant one thing. And 1974, when Joseph and Jack and I were teaching at Naropa Institute in Boulder, which was the first beginning, really, of our teaching in this country, Celestial Seasonings opened up. And all of a sudden, it was like this explosion of tea. And it meant so many different things. Or I can recall when the first time I ever, I actually can recall the first time I ever heard about a fax machine. A friend came back from Boston and said, I saw this incredible machine. It can take diagrams and photos and things and send it somewhere else. And the retreat center, IMS, which I live next door to, got a fax machine long before I did. And I can remember being at my house and asking somebody who was there and on his way over to the center if he would please send a fax for me. And then I said to him, and please make a copy of it first so that I retain a copy. You know, I don't know what I thought. Like the machine was going to like eat it up, you know, and like spin it through space or something. And he said, oh, okay. And then he came back maybe half an hour later and he said, well, that just proved that neither of us understands anything about a fax machine. You know, and change is just, it's the nature of our lives and every day, every moment. Although we can live oblivious to that. Change doesn't just mean loss or tentativeness or instability. It also means opening and beginnings and renewal. It's all there. And the reason I was contemplating this is because that statement that I seem to often make, it doesn't matter what you're experiencing in your meditation practice, is because in terms of insight practice or mindfulness practice, ultimately what we are looking at is change itself. Whether it's a painful experience or a lovely experience, whether it's a sensation in the body or a sound or a thought, everything is expressive of change because that's what lies at the heart of life. It's movement, it's pulsation, it's rhythm, it's coming and going. So we are working on many levels in mindfulness. We're paying attention to the immediate nature of something. We feel the breath as it is, not as we demand it to be or as we imagine it might be tomorrow. We feel this breath. We feel this sensation in the body. Hopefully without adding on a whole lot of future projection, like this is what it's going to feel like tomorrow. We see the immediate nature of certain emotions. If strong anger arises or jealousy or joy or whatever, we look at it. We take a look. So that it's not because we've been told about a certain emotion or have been taught about it to view it in a certain way, but because we perceive it. Oh, that's what anger does to my body, to my mood. That's what joy does. So we see the immediate nature of these different elements of our experience, and we see a more shared nature. Because if we look deep into that anger and deep into that jealousy and deep into that joy, we will see change. And so that is what the meditation is including, both levels actually, the immediate nature and you could call it the more ultimate nature. And in terms of change and movement and those other laws of nature that we see, they're evident in anything. It's not just nice and pleasant experience that will reveal the truth of change. Everything will. That's why it doesn't matter. There's a saying in the Chinese tradition that if you want to understand the nature of water, look at the waves. So we look at the waves of our experience, but if we look into any one of them with enough clarity and enough open-mindedness, enough open-heartedness, we'll see change. So you don't have to feel, I mean, of course, you know, as human beings, somebody handed you a menu on your way in here and they said, what would you like to feel? You probably wouldn't check off knee pain, restlessness, sleepiness, boredom, you know, but that run of experience doesn't make it a bad meditation. It doesn't make us bad people. Because we can look into each one of those and see as much about change as we can look into joy and serenity and peace and happiness. So we can have a kind of freedom in our spirit as we approach the meditation instead of being so kind of like strategizing. Well, you know, if I do this, then I won't have any pain, and then, you know, there won't be any disruptive thoughts, and I won't have that problem, and, you know, because it's just not like that. We can be freer than that. We don't have to be afraid of anything or call it bad. You know, that's so bad. Just look right into it. Look at the changing nature. So that's really, you could almost say, at the heart of insight meditation is inclusivity in that way. There's no experience we can't include in our field of awareness or mindfulness. Because, as we say, mindfulness doesn't take the shape of what it's watching. It can go anywhere. I mean, of course, we want serenity. We want nice feeling. I mean, that's only natural. But that doesn't mean that all those times of difficulty are bad or wrong. They're just challenging in their own way. So look right into whatever's going on. Everything is included. That makes our practice really big. Instead of feeling, you know, I've got to do this, and I've got to arrange that, and I've got to do that, and the phone can't ring, and, you know, oh no, they sneezed, it ruined my life, you know. We can open to anything. So inclusivity is really like the hallmark of insight practice. And of course it is the hallmark of loving kindness practice as well. In loving kindness practice, what we are working on including are, first of all, different aspects of ourselves in that field of care or connection, and then different elements of life, those we feel really close to, those who've helped us and inspired us, those who we feel at ease with, like our friends, those whom we don't know, you know, we run into in an airport or you don't have subways here, and I just read about that this morning, buses or, you know, what we call in the teachings the neutral people, those whom we feel irritated with or annoyed by or a little bit afraid of, those we have difficulty with, everybody in the end. We include and we include and we include. Very much, as I was saying yesterday, in that spirit of exploration, not because we're trying to act like we're so good, you know, or pretend to be something that we're not, or in that kind of gooey sort of sentimentality that is sickly sweet, like that man said to me, a continually enforced Valentine's Day. You know, it's nothing like that. But it's understanding how we use our awareness, who we pay attention to, what we pay attention to. When we look at ourselves, we look at somebody else. All those we don't pay attention to. It's understanding how we hold our place in life, what we consider as of import or in relationship to us and everything that we leave out of that consideration. It's understanding how what we care about, what we aspire to, what we feel dedicated to affects how we speak to one another and how we behave with one another day to day. That's really the terrain or the ground of loving kindness. It's understanding. It's seeing what we care about and its consequences. It's seeing how our energy can be held back or it can be open. So those four practices that I talked about yesterday are really the like the center point of this exploration. It's loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Together making up what are called the four Brahmaviharas, or our best home. If you've got to hang out somewhere, this is a good place. And the reason I like that phrase, best home, is because I think we know that feeling, whether it's actual in our lives or just idealized, we know that feeling of being at home. It's like the place where we do not have to pretend to be somebody else. And we don't have to act just for the gratification of some external role. But we can be ourselves most fully. That's our sense of being at home. And so these four qualities form our best home. And I think they are both innate qualities, innate to our being, although perhaps undiscovered. You know, very often these qualities are not something we believe about ourselves. It's not something we trust. It's not something we're in touch with. But they're still there. And they're also skills. They're about how we pay attention, how we use our attention, what we learn to let go of, and why. It is like a skills training. And each one of them can be seen in just that way. With loving kindness, as I said, you know, it can be translated as friendship. There are actually different preliminary reflections that are sometimes done, which are indicative of how it really is about how we use our attention, how we use our awareness. One reflection, and remember that these practices, this practice begins with oneself. One reflection is on looking for the good in someone, beginning with ourselves, rather than just fixating and being consumed by the negative and what's wrong and what's difficult and what's conflicted. We actually make an effort to reflect on, even if it's momentary, even if it's small, something good about somebody, perhaps ourselves. And this isn't done, you know, in that spirit of, well, let's pretend everything is just fine and live in denial and push away everything that's wrong. But it is much more in that sense of, if all we do is think of what's negative, we will feel further and further and further distant from ourselves or this other person. Whereas if we can find one little sliver that's good, something they've done, something they've said, then we almost have a sense of standing side by side with this person and looking honestly and directly at what's difficult, but from that sense of having some connection. And this, I know some of you have heard me say this before, was a practice that I really did not like. You know, when I went to learn these four Brahmaviharas intensively, systematically for the first time, it was in Burma in 1985, and I'd always done it. you know, here and there for an hour or something like that. And I tried actually to do it more intensively when we first moved into IMS, but the first time I really got to do it with a teacher in an intensive way was in Burma in 1985. So I went off there to study with Saira Upandita. And at one point he said, you know, now you should go back to your room and, you know, think of this person and look for the good in them. And my first thought was, I don't want to do that. I'm not going to do that. I thought that's what stupid people do. You know, they kind of go around looking for the good in everybody. I don't even like people like that. You know, just going around looking for the good in people. I'm not going to do that. But as I usually tell the story, I was very far from home. I was in a Burmese monastery. And the nature of the teacher-student relationship in a very traditional culture like that is not one where the teacher suggests you do something and you say, I don't feel like it. You do it. And so I did it. And much to my amazement, it really worked. It worked in precisely the way they said it would work, not to put me into this daze, you know, of pretending everything was just fine. But I actually felt differently toward the people, even as I admitted the difficulty of their behavior for me. And it was so interesting because I did not want to do it. I thought of somebody who I found kind of obnoxious. And I thought of actually a very tender moment when he went out of his way to help somebody else I knew. And I thought, I don't want to think about that. You know, I would rather just cast him in a certain kind of solidified role as all bad. Isn't true. So that's one of the reflections. The other reflection is really for the times that it's not going to work. It's just unreal. Whether you're looking at yourself in a really bad day or you're looking at somebody else, it's completely unrealistic that you are going to find something good. And so the other reflection is this very simple teaching of the Buddhas that all beings everywhere want to be happy. Everybody wants to be happy. It's because of ignorance, it's because of not knowing that we get lost, we get confused, we make mistakes that cause sometimes tremendous suffering for ourselves and for others. But if we look deeper into any of those actions, we would see something in that person that wants to be part of something bigger than their limited sense of self, wants to feel a sense of completeness. As my friend Krishnadas puts it, we just have bad aim. You know, we're just like reaching out for something that will cause that feeling, that will amplify that feeling of rightness, of wholeness. And we reach out to so many wrong places again and again. And that urge toward happiness, which in many ways is the most appropriate thing about us, gets twisted and distorted and sometimes made truly awful by the ignorance. But in and of itself, it's got a kind of purity. And this is very fundamental to loving kindness. All beings want to be happy. And that includes us. It's okay to want to be happy. I think people ask, you know, zillions of times in the context of loving kindness practice, isn't this greed to want to be happy? You know, I think this is just like desire. You know, I thought we weren't supposed to be into desire. But it's like a rightful desire. It's appropriate. It's good. Because it's not so personal. It's not like, may I be happy and everyone else, you know, lose it. But we are touching something within us that is shared by others. May all beings be happy. All beings deserve to be happy. And I know less than anybody else. And all of these thoughts and considerations and confusions are reflected in the practice because it's a practice. So that is, I think you know, we silently repeat certain phrases in doing this practice, beginning with ourselves, very simple phrases, which might be things like, may I be happy. And people say, they hear themselves in their mind saying things like, may I be happy? No way. You know, so all of this stuff comes up. It's very interesting just to have it arise, see it wash through. Yeah, may I be happy? Because it's right, that's true. We should be happy. Everybody should be happy. So we see loving kindness in that way as a use of attention. What are we paying attention to? As one of my friends was having a very difficult time at work bringing his values and the things he really wanted to live by into the workplace. And he came up to Barry, he came up to IMS, and he was talking to somebody, one of the teachers there. And she said to him, do you believe that everybody has within them a seed of growth and potential and, you know, the ability to change? Not the full flowering, but do you believe everybody has within them that kind of seed? And he said yes, you know, with great conviction. He just said yes. He really believed that. So then she said to him, well, when you're at work and you're talking to people, talk to that seed. And I thought, wow, that's kind of stunning advice, you know? You think about how we usually are in an exchange. You know, we have such a tremendous habit of self-absorption. Like, what do they think of me? Do they like me? Am I impressive? You know, am I impressing them more than they've ever felt with anybody else ever before? Oh, no, I just said something really wrong. They're going to hate me. They're going to hate me forever. How can I make up for that? Oh, no. You know, it's just like so much of our energy is taken up in this continual self-absorption instead of just feeling a sort of natural place of connection and interest in seeing what might emerge. I don't know if you've ever had the experience. I think it's very fun. If you're talking to somebody and you're not really listening to them because you're consumed with something else, like something else you need to do, or you have a very strong preconception about them and you've already slotted them into their category, you know, and you think, oh, I don't have to pay any attention to them because I know, oh, God, they're always so dreary and, you know, whatever it is, I know what they're going to say, I know who they are. And then something happens, you know, because of your own practice or your intention or something happens in the environment, so you actually, like, listen. Or you look at them, you pay attention to them, and there's surprises there. Maybe they're not exactly the person you thought they were, limited to that response or behavior. Maybe there's some complexity there. Maybe there's a different point of view. Maybe there's a layer of kind of an emotional reality you hadn't tuned into in any way. It's just like stopping the machine of our normal distraction and habitual reaction and almost like disdain for others, which is not paying attention to them. Stopping that machine and paying attention. There is a lot of discovery there. That's what loving kindness is. We happen to use phrases as the vehicle for that attention in the formal practice. We use the phrases not as a kind of magical thinking, you know, like if I say, may I be healthy loud enough and fast enough, I'll never get sick. And we don't say it as a kind of insistence or attachment, but it's just the vehicle for that awareness, for that attention, for that energy. So that it has a conduit for joining us to others. So the phrases, the actual phrases are, in a way, they're not so important. They don't matter either. But the energy they're conveying, or the interest, the quality of attention, that's what's really important. It's just one way of doing it. And the other thing that doesn't matter so much is the feeling level. Even though it's nourishing, it's renewing, it's wonderful, it's inspiring when, you know, we're offering someone loving kindness and we're filled with this dazzling warmth, and it's great, but it doesn't matter. Because the power of the practice is happening on a deeper level, which has to do with intentionality, it has to do with energy, it has to do with awareness. And that can be cooking right along and doing quite well without that kind of fullness of emotion. It's just happening in a different level. And that's the level that's really important. What are we gathering our energy behind? What are we committed to? What are we paying attention to? Who are we paying attention to? Can we see our own sense of limitation and dissolve it? Can we see our feeling that we don't deserve to be happy and dissolve it? Can we see the feeling I described yesterday of like offering loving kindness to someone like the Dalai Lama and feeling inconsequential, feeling unimportant? Dissolve that. That's what is the movement of the practice. So we have loving kindness, we have compassion, we have sympathetic joy, and we have equanimity. They're all very supportive of one another. They're all part of the same whole in a way, the same home, you could actually say. And sometimes we do the practices separately as a kind of evolution with different qualities emphasized in each one. Very often we do them together because they support one another so much. And there are layers within any one practice which are implicitly the other practices. So if we take equanimity, for example, which means balance of mind, it does not mean indifference or callousness or not caring. It means balance. And we pay attention to how things actually are. The wisdom of that clear seeing brings about that equanimity. So I often call equanimity the voice or the articulation of wisdom. It's seeing what we're not in control of. It's seeing how we can offer our hearts and be strong and be committed, and we also need to let go, because we can't demand either an instant or a particular response. If you go back to what I was saying yesterday about practices like loving kindness being practices of generosity, we all understand, I think, the feeling and the nature of a freely given gift. When we give something just for the giving of it, it seems right, it seems appropriate, maybe it seems important, we just do it. And then there are those other times when we give something and we're kind of waiting to be thanked in a particular way, or it's an exchange, you know, we think, oh, well, maybe I'll give you this and you'll give me that, or, you know, there's a kind of calculation there, or there's even a desperation there. You've got to be thanked. You're not going to think well of yourself unless you're thanked in a particular way, you know, with a particular intensity. And there's so many ways that act of giving could be made more complex and less free by all these other forces. And so that's like an example of equanimity and loving kindness. We have to understand that we make the offering. We don't know if there's going to be a particular result. We need equanimity, we need balance to actually freely give of our energy, of our care. Otherwise, it becomes what one of my friends called metta. You know, metta is the Pali word for loving kindness. He called it metta with an edge. You know, like, may you be happy by tonight in this particular way, or I'm giving up on you. You know, it suddenly becomes layered with conditions. It's only when we have some balance that we realize you give for the sake of giving. It doesn't mean nothing ever comes as a result, or even that we don't want a result, but there's wisdom there. We see what we're not in control of. And so that's just one way in which equanimity is actually implicit in the practice of loving kindness. Otherwise it would be very different, like be happy. And people say sometimes, you know, I teach a loving kindness retreat every winter in Barrie. I don't know how I ended up with the February slot, but I did. And we go through all these different categories of offering loving kindness in the retreat. And sometimes, you know, people will leave the retreat and they'll say, and I'll run into them later, you know, some city, somewhere. And they'll say, well, you know, I was sort of disappointed because, you know, I spent all that time offering loving kindness to my friend, and then I saw them, you know, when I got out, and they were no better than they were before, you know. And I thought, I gave you a week. You know, why aren't you better? And we see that kind of thing all the time in our minds. That's the role of equanimity, to be able to see that thought, let it go, because we know better. In a way, equanimity is like knowing better. It's knowing how things are, that we want, we care, we try, we're there, and we can't decide how someone's going to live their life. We can't make their choices for them. We can't control the unfolding of the universe. It's not that we don't care. It's not coldness. It's like a kind of peace that comes from living in harmony with how things are. They may not be the way we want them to be, but that's how they are. And that peace doesn't make us try less hard. It's the only thing that gives us the kind of sustained energy to hang in there. Because so much, I know this so well from my own life, and perhaps you do too, when we're in a situation where we can't make it better, how often our own sense of helplessness or powerlessness really rules the day. It becomes more primary, you know, more pronounced than the actual difficult situation we were trying to help with. And so we pull back. What allows us to actually hang in there and be present and be caring without the gratification of an immediate and desired result? It's that kind of balance. That's where it really comes from, is that sustained, continual effort is born out of some kind of balance. Otherwise, we go in and we burn out. It's just gone. We practice loving kindness, and there's compassion implicit in it. Compassion toward the difficulties everybody faces, because everybody does. Compassion with our own difficulties. Compassion doesn't mean weakness. It doesn't mean that we've given up trying to make change. It doesn't mean feeling bad either. One of the things that was interesting in the conference I was at with the researchers was sort of a discussion about the difference between empathy and compassion. You know, empathy, as they were defining it, being the ability to feel what someone else was feeling, but kind of stopping there. So as I said in a comment at the conference, well, then you could say empathy was like ethically neutral, because you could feel what someone else is feeling and just go into a tailspin of great personal distress. Compassion being a particular response to that empathic connection, where your own distress is not the most significant thing going on, but that urge to be of help, to make a difference. Not that we always can, but it's that sense of moving toward, of caring. It's the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to pain. So there's compassion in our loving kindness practice as we recognize, yeah, this is how things are. There's change. We go up, we go down. Everybody, whenever their time is there, is going to go down. It's just how things are. And we care about that. And there's sympathetic joy in the practice of loving kindness as well. Knowing that we go up and we go down and that everything changes. It's so fragile. When we remember that, we don't really tend to begrudge people's happiness quite so much. I think this is the most fascinating quality to really explore, sympathetic joy. To be happy for the happiness of others instead of feeling so bad that they got something. As though our lives would really be immeasurably improved if they lost it. You know, usually it has no effect on our life. It's not going to be given to us, you know, if it's taken away from them. But still, we just assume they didn't have it, you know. It's really quite interesting. And then to explore the path to the opposite. I mean, there's really an act of generosity to feel happy for someone else's happiness. To be willing to add to their delight by our own rejoicing. It's quite fascinating what holds us back, what lets us go forward. And I wanted to say in response to one of the questions yesterday, but I didn't get a chance, it was sort of in this light. You know, one of the things that is said to sometimes hold us back from sympathetic joy is it's like an insistence on being right. And sometimes people are happy not through like ill-gotten gains or mistreating others or things like that, but they're happy and they've made a different choice than we would have wished for them. And it's hard to let go of one's own opinion and just say, be happy, wow. You know, you're doing it in your own way. You're making your choices. You're kind of living out those choices. That's great. You know, usually we're so affronted by them not taking our advice or our opinion that becomes what we're kind of consumed by. And I had that experience once where this young man came to me. He's someone I had known. And he wanted to bring his father to India to meet this particular teacher. And he asked me what I thought about it. And I said, you know, I think it's a really bad idea. You know, that particular season in India and that particular city is going to be really hot. And, you know, so there'll be a lot of physical discomfort and there'll be bugs. And, you know, maybe the food's not so good and he's likely to get sick. And besides, the scene around the teacher is pretty strange, you know, and I think he'll get really turned off and, you know, just all these things. So the young man didn't listen to me at all. And he planned this trip with his father and brought him to India to meet this teacher. And the father had like the best time of his entire life and fell in love with the teacher. He became a disciple of the teacher. And then started teaching in the teacher's tradition, you know, so his entire life literally changed from that trip where I had just predicted doom. You know, and then they came back and the young man, you know, I ran into him somewhere and he told me about his father's experience in India and I thought, whoops, you know. And I could feel my mind at that juncture, which is most important? That they're happy, or that they should have listened to me. You know, it's those kind of moments. What do we pay attention to? What do we care about more than anything? can we let go of our own feeling of, well, they should have listened to me, or I was wrong, I can't believe it, that's so embarrassing, and just be happy for them. So there's sympathetic joy all of the time in our practice of loving kindness. As we look at beings and wish them well, do we think, well, may you be a little bit happy, but not happier than me? And or can we just be happy? And then, of course, there is equanimity in our practice of loving kindness, because that has got to be there as the context, or it's not really loving kindness. It's not really generosity. So even though, as I said, you can practice each of these individually, and we sometimes do, we also just take one, like the practice of loving kindness, and see the threads of the others throughout. And that's, you know, what I'd like to do for the rest of the day. And to begin with, I'd actually like to do it through walking practice. And I'll give you some instruction for walking. We'll come back, do a sitting, and then have the lunch break, do another walking, and then come back and have lots of time for discussion and so on in the afternoon. The walking practice in loving kindness is done also through the silent repetition of certain phrases. Rather than focusing your attention on the feeling of the sensations in the movement, the focal point becomes these phrases. Sometimes people like to say them along with the step, you know, and they coordinate, or you can just leave aside the awareness of the step or have that be in the background and just focus on the phrases. It's really up to you. And what I would suggest is that you, and here you can walk as quickly as you want. You don't have to move really slowly unless you choose to. And, just kind of get out there. It's very good if you can get outside. Is that you really center your attention on the repetition of the phrases for yourself. And then, if a being comes strongly into your consciousness, you walk by somebody, you hear a bird, you hear a dog, you see a worm, just for a moment, make an offering of love to them. Be happy. And then come back to the repetition of phrases directed toward yourself. You don't want to sort of be scanning, because there's a lot of life out there. You know, so the center point really is the phrases for yourself. But you're open to acknowledging others. Just in that simple, kind of easy way, be happy. And then come back. So traditionally there are four phrases that are used. You can use these four, or you can make up your own. It can be three or four, something like that, in that range. And beginning with oneself, these are, may I be safe, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I live with ease. This last means in the things of day-to-day life, like livelihood and family, may not be a struggle. You don't have to use these phrases. The idea is that they're big enough, they're general enough, so it's something you can be offering to yourself, not just for today, you know, like may I make it to the bookstore before it closes, but in an enduring way, and something you can offer to others. You know, that's why they're so general. And if, you know, you want to rephrase it, or, as I said, just leave it aside and make up your own. You don't want to spend too much time trying to think of the perfect phrase. But choose three or four. And again, the traditional ones are, may I be safe, be happy, be healthy, live with ease. And I can assure you that the meanings of like happy and healthy and so on will deepen, they'll change over time. So if you don't feel like it's absolutely perfect, it doesn't matter. But you should feel good about it, you know, it should be something you feel in accord with. You choose three or four phrases, let your attention settle on the repetition of the phrases. As you walk, direct it toward yourself. Then when other beings come into consciousness, you see them, you hear them, you think of them, just for a moment, be happy. And then come back. Okay? So we'll let's try to be back here at 11:35 at the very latest, okay?
A question. This is the kind of thing that my mind just gets really hung up on. Do you do the repetitions in sequence, or do you just do one for a really long time and then change it something?
You can actually do either.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid of.
Yeah. In that case, let me suggest you do them in sequence.
You
know, do all four and then go back.